You're listening to Trucking Questions from the Audio Road with Kevin Rutherford. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. You can ask questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, tax, technology, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the Audio Road.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, buying and selling trucks and trailers, you name it, we'll take your call. That's what we do here. So you're in the right place. If you've got questions, we've got answers. We're going to, I'll tell you what, we're going to jump right into those calls today, and I'm going to see how many we can get to this hour. Let's go ahead and get started in New Jersey. Danny, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing? I spoke to you about a month ago, and we spoke about doing some upgrades on my Peterbilt 387 with a Caterpillar Acer 2007.
Okay.
And increasing my fuel mileage. OPS put in, I got the air filter. I also did what they call the Air Dog Champ screw-on filter for the air on the fuel. It's like the fast system.
Okay.
I did do some fuel line changes. My question is that I have is that now I'm thinking, I did see a difference on my fuel mileage. What I want to do now is I was looking at the Acer single turbo converter kit.
Well, that's kind of a generic term. There are a lot of companies out there doing, we could call it all kinds of things. Acer deletes, taking an Acer back to a standard C15 and 6NZ. But there's lots of different ways to do it. First off, there's the mechanical part. Just putting on a single turbo doesn't do it. I mean, there are some really functional parts inside that engine. Acer is virtually the same as EGR. It's just EGR is exhaust gas recirculation and all the parts are on the outside of the engine. Acer technology is bringing the exhaust gas back into the combustion chamber. It just does it internally, primarily with the valves. So there's no simple way to do this. You don't just take off two turbos and bolt on one. So when you say a kit, I have no idea whose it is or what they're doing. What was the price that you've seen? Danny, are you still there? Oh, boy. I think I lost you. I still see the line there. I'm going to put you on hold and maybe see if, nope, looks like we lost that call. I'm going to head off to Georgia. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I've got a pull of a flatbed trailer, spread axle. I've got my front axle to where I can dump the air out of it and hook it with a chain and then let the air back in my back axle and lift that axle without having to spend $700 on a lift axle kit. But I was thinking about doing the front axle on my truck. I got a 2003 T600 Kenworth, and it's got the AG400 suspension on it, the one that's got that bar plate in the middle, and it's got the two bars that holds the axles. A guy called in a while back about gutting the front housing and cutting a hole in it and plating it up and sealing the axle off. And I was wondering if you heard anything back from him about that, and would I be able to do that on this front axle with the AG400 suspension on that?
I never heard back from him, and I don't really know the details on all the different suspensions and how you would do this. Over the years, people have called me and they've said they've done this. One of the things you've got to check into, and I'm trying to picture this suspension. I know I've seen it, looked at it, but I'm not all that familiar with it. when we do a lift axle, one of the things you have to do is run the drive shaft from the transmission straight to the rear axle or with the carrier bearing. But in order to get an axle to lift, you've got to use a U-shaped axle so that it lifts and goes around the drive shaft that's now coming straight through to the back axle.
Right.
So you can create a dead axle up front. Making it liftable is not simple.
Yeah. Well, I got an old truck at the house, and I thought about gutting the front housing out on it and just experimenting and cutting a hole in the back of it and running a piece of PVC pipe through there as a makeshift drive axle and see if it'll clear and put some air in it and let it down and see how much clearance I got on it. But the suspension that I got is the eight bag air suspension, and I let the air out of it today to look at it to see how much clearance I would have, and it looks like it would lift it up if I I'd have to pretty much do it like I got my trailer with a chain and everything, but it looks like it would lift it up the length of the size of the tire from the ground to the bottom of the rim. It looks like it would lift it up that high, but I would probably have to kind of a oval shape the hole in the housing in order to get the drive shaft to go through there. But I didn't know if that guy ever called you back on that. But if you didn't know anything about it, I was going to experiment on that old truck I got at the house and see what it looks like. Because I mean, it's not drivable, so all I got to do is put air in the bags and see if I can do it. But I was just checking to see if you heard anything about it.
No, I haven't heard back. And again, like I say, I think doing a lift X on the front and making it liftable using all the current parts is really difficult. I think you're going to run into some challenges. If you're really good at fabrication, you might be able to pull this off. And I love people who experiment. Absolutely. I mean, that's how we learn stuff. Just picturing this. My mind and knowing when we do a lift axle, the U shape, the drop on it, I think, if I'm trying to remember right, the drop is 9 inches in order to get enough space to clear the drive shaft when we lift with a 9-inch drop. And I think
is that drop going up? Is it going up under the drive shaft or has it got to be above the drive shaft?
Now, the drop is under so that when you lift it, it still clears. And for some reason, 9 inches is the number that's sticking in my head. But even with that much of a drop, we don't get a ton of clearance on those tires. I mean, we get a couple inches off the ground, and that's enough.
Because I was thinking that if it being up under it, whenever the suspension flexes, and you got that axle lifted up 9 inches. I'm thinking you might have more clearance if you do the most of the clearance on top, because with that front axle lifted, either way, you're going to have the thing on it. I'm going to try to do this, Kevin. And if I can get it done and on the other truck and get it lifted where the airbag in it and all that lifted and everything, I'm going to take some pictures of it and maybe put it on the Let's Truck page on there.
Yeah, that'd be great. Matt just sent me a message. Matt did one of the early lift axles when we first started talking about doing this. You know, we did one on the original Signature truck, and not long after that, I think Matt did his, and he was telling me he did a 6-inch, and he says he'd much rather have the 9-inch. That is the number that I remembered.
9 inches.
Yeah. Okay. And that's how much of a drop there is from, you know, where the axle starts to come out and then drops down to create that notch. And that allows us to get a couple inches of clearance on the wheels.
Well, I'm thinking pretty sure that housing is more than 18 inches in diameter then. So if it's 18 inches in diameter, I should be good to go on top or bottom then.
Yeah, that's possible. And like I say, you know, over the years, we've had people do this, you know, from scratch. And this is how we learn stuff. So, yeah, if you've got something to play around with, I'd love to see what you come up with.
All right, I sure will. If I can get it done, I'll put some pictures on your page.
All right, great stuff. All right, I'm going to take us into the break. When we get back, we'll get to more of your calls and questions. It's that time of year. Tell me what happened on your tax return. How'd you do this year? If you're an owner-operator, did you get hit hard? Were you prepared? What was tax season like? Did you file an extension? If so, don't forget about taxes. Don't wait. Just get it done. The extension bought you a little breathing room, but don't wait. If you need any help, give us a call. It's 855-800-FUEL. 855-800-3835. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's go to New Jersey. Alex, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How are you? This is my second time. I'm happy to say that my I-40 became active already. I'm going to start hauling my first loads with HMN Bay, which was excellent for me. You know, I have a pretty good deal with them.
But
three quick questions. You know, I'm not going to get into much detail because I know you very deep. I know you tell me about getting a more aerodynamic truck. I got a sweet deal on a nice 2007 Coronado.
Hold on. Stop right there. That's an oxymoron. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as a sweet deal on an 07.
Okay.
If somebody gave me an 07, I wouldn't consider it a sweet deal. I wouldn't own one.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a 14-liter. A friend of mine, I know he runs a 14-liter, and he knows how to sort of bypass the EGR valve with a sensor that you install. And the truck basically runs like a 12.7. You know what I mean?
No,
but that's one issue.
I do know the sensor. It's an atmospheric pressure sensor, so it tricks the truck into thinking you're at high altitude, which mm-hmm. closes the EGR valve. But that's only one small part of what's going on. And we've talked to, I bet I've talked to 50 plus people that have that, and the results are really mixed. You know, if we test the technology here, fuel mileage, whatever it is, we do pretty rigorous testing. I talk to a lot of people. I want to see at least a 70% positive result. So if I talk to 10 people, I need to hear from at least 7 that really document their results. And what I mean by that is some people say, oh yeah, I put this thing on and my truck runs great. That doesn't mean much to me. That is way too subjective. It's like the placebo effect with medicine. You give somebody a sugar pill and they feel better. And that's an absolute true thing. It's been documented many times. Our mind's that powerful. We do something to our truck and we swear it runs better. That isn't enough. We want to see documented fuel mileage increases 30 days before, 30 days after, control as many variables as possible. And we want to see a 70% positive result. When I talk about this, I think one company calls it the ugly fix.
That's what it's called, the ugly fix.
You know, I get such mixed results out of this, and the people who are really documenting, we didn't even get half. So, and it makes sense that we wouldn't, because closing the EGR valve is only one part of the equation. I mean, there's so much more going on in the ECM. And so I'm just, plus that doesn't solve the problems of V-pods going bad, turbo actuators not working right, all the other sensors and maintenance issues we face. I just would not own one of these trucks. Plus, you know, to fix them right, to get rid of all the junk, they're amazing engines. The problem there, and I've talked about it many times, is the EPA seems to be cracking down on this stuff. And we've heard stories of people being forced to put all that stuff back on, which is outrageously expensive. So we're looking at, and this is just, this is what I would do. It's the only thing I could recommend to anybody else. I would either buy a true pre-emission truck, 03 or older. I would build a glider, or I would look for a used glider. Those are really the only three options I would go with. I just will not own one of these trucks.
Okay. Well, I know that, and I'm just going to, I thought the same thing, so I'm not going to go with that. I'm just going to buy another classic and do a whole bunch of other stuff to get it where my mind is right now. I almost 7 miles to the gallon, which is pretty good for that. The other two questions, Kevin, something that has me really worried is now, I want to know what you think and what advice you can give me. I just find out they're going to put e-locks on all small companies. I mean, I don't run illegal by any means. I don't, because I run a little bit faster in order to stay legal. And I own my own business, so I don't really have to comply with other people, so I time myself better. But how about this limiter? Because, I mean, you know, I know you got to run, you know, you're not supposed to run a semi-truck 70 miles an hour because of, you know, the kinetic energy and the effects of crashing at 70 miles an hour, it's worse than crashing at 55. But, you know, sometimes you do need that little bit of leeway, you know what I mean? I think they should keep it at 70.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Let me first just talk about e-logs and speed limiters. The last thing I want is more government. I wish they would just get the hell out of our business and let us run business and let the market decide competition and all that other stuff. So I don't want to see any of that stuff happen. I'm not in favor of any of it. Now, having said that, it's coming. And unless we can drastically change our government, which I don't see that happening. There's so many directions I could go on this, but I need to stay focused. We're not going to change our government anytime soon. So those things are coming. Now, even though I don't want to see any of those things, they would have had zero effect on my business because I always ran my trucks legal. And when I say always, I'm going back 20 some years. If I look at the first 5 years I was in business back in the late 80s, I didn't run legal. I didn't run slow. When I say always, I'm talking about the last 20 years or so. Always ran legal as far as hours and never really exceeded 57 miles an hour. So it can be done. I know thousands of owner operators now that run legal hours and very slow speeds and make a tremendous amount of money. It requires change. So you've got a couple choices the way I see it. You can keep fighting the system, and it used to be fairly easy to fight the system. I mean, it was easy to fudge your logs a little bit. And I'm not talking about crazy stuff. You know, I'm not talking about running, you know, 20 hours straight and keeping three logbooks. And it was easy enough to fudge your logs a little bit. You know, if you were 2 hours away from home, you drove home and you fixed your logbooks later. Yeah, it was easy to decide whatever speed you wanted to run. I think those things are going to go away. So will there be ways around it? Probably. I mean, any time they come up with a rule, we can usually figure out a way to break the rule if we want. Or you can start now learning how to run your business in a way that I think is better anyway. Not because the government's forcing us to, but I've done it both ways. I've helped hundreds of people convert from running hard, running fast to running by the numbers, and everybody says it's more relaxing. They're making more money. I started about a year ago telling people you should get your own e-logs right now. before you're forced to and before you have to run by them. Get the e-log and start using it. They're cheap. You can get apps for your phone. Most GPSs now have, the truck GPSs have e-logs built in. Why not start using one right now and start adjusting your operation to the point where you can run reasonable speeds and reasonable hours? And that way, when it is forced on everybody, you'll already be there and everything will be fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're going to force my, I was giving it a really good thought about this. And I mean, I just, if that comes happen, that really takes a real bad effect on me. I'm just going to run team. I mean, they're not going to stop my operation. I'm just going to get the getting out running reefers under my own authority. And I'm just going to go on team. And I find out I can make more money like that too, because I mean, I have a load with H&M Day coming up in the next week that's paying me $5,000. You know, and it's a six stop load. It goes from Texas all the way up to Massachusetts. And I mean, I know it's taking me like 30 hours to do it. So I mean, I know if I'm on team, I can make a pretty significant amount of money. So I'm just going to have to.
Well, I completely agree that teams are really going to be one of the answers to a lot of these problems. There's another thing I've been working on, the whole health issue. And we know this is a horribly unhealthy industry. It's an unhealthy job. And one of the things that I'm learning is we need to move more often. You know, I'm one of those guys, when I get out on the road, I will stay at it for 8 hours straight. I don't need to take breaks. I can go many days. I can go 8 hours without stopping. You make great time that way. And that's one of the ways I was able to drive 57 miles an hour. I didn't screw around. I didn't stop. But it's very, very unhealthy. We should actually be getting up and moving like every hour. Now, that's really difficult when you're in a truck to make any kind of time. But I'm looking at ways to maybe come up with, you know, a schedule where you could stop every 2 hours for a little bit. And honestly, if it's a team operation, the time you lose stopping is not that big of a deal because you've got so much more flexibility. As a single driver, you start driving slow, driving legal, and stopping every 2 hours. It really does cut into your production time. So I'm looking at some of these options. I think teams really make life a lot easier and a lot better. And I know not everybody wants to run team. I really don't like teams unless it was my spouse. So we've got some challenges, but I think challenges always create a lot of opportunities. The good news is you're looking at it, you're thinking about it, you'll come up with solutions that work for you. Stick around, we'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Hey, I want to let you know about our recording schedule. 3 days a week, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, we do recordings. Anywhere from 1 hour to 3 hours, just depending on what's going on that day. It's real simple to join us, though. I'm going to tell you how to do this. So grab something to write with, something to write on, hit record, whatever you do to capture information. We do it on the same schedule every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. Now, it's real simple to join us. All you do is dial a number. That's it. You just dial a number on your phone, sit and listen. And if you want to ask a question, you can jump in. It's usually much easier to get through and ask your question on the recorded hour. So the first thing I'm going to do is give you the direct number to call in while we're recording. And what you could do is just put a reminder in your phone. That is one of the beauties of technology today. Put a reminder in your phone for every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. Put this number in the reminder. And at those times, just call us. and sit and listen or jump in and ask a question. The direct number to call in is 347-884-8327. I'll give you that one more time. 347-884-8327. Now, I'm going to give you another way so that we will remind you every time we're going to record. This also works for all of our podcast shows as well, and I don't have time to give you all those schedules. But if you get on our text message list, then we'll send you a text message every time a podcast is coming up or one of our recording times is coming up. And it's real simple to get on the text message list. Either write this down or just grab your phone right now and open up your text message app. And here's what you do. You text one word, just the word listen. That's all you put in the body of the text. Just listen. Don't worry about capitalization or anything else. Type the word listen and send it to this number, 99,000. 99000. That's what's called a short code for texting. It's just like texting to a phone number. So you text the word listen to 99,000. Wait about 30 seconds or so. You'll get a response back. When you see the response, you know you're in the system. And then every time we're going to be recording or one of our podcast shows is coming up, we will send you a text message with the phone number. Just click on the phone number on your phone and you'll be joining us for the recording. Let's get back to some phone calls. Let's head off to Texas. Lee, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing, bro?
Doing good. What's on your mind today?
Well, sir, I wanted you to give me a summary on my oil analysis. Now, it's an 05 KW W900L. It is an old Swift truck. Brought it out of a junkyard. It has 03 ISX in it. So there's approximately 200,000 less mileage on the motor than there is on the truck.
Okay. So let's see. I was taking a look at the oil sample while you were talking there. So let me make sure these numbers are right then. Is it 1.1 million on the engine, or is that what's on the truck?
No, on the truck, right. There'd be about 900,000 on the engine.
So about 900,000 and 25,000 on the oil. And this looks like a good sample. Now, this is a different lab, so it takes me a little longer to look at it. But I'm not seeing, well, what oil is this?
Rotel.
1540?
1540, correct. And I run 1 gallon of Lucas.
I was just going to say, you've got some Lucas in here because your viscosity is pretty high. It's up at 17. That doesn't hurt anything. And on a high mileage engine, it'll help protect the engine a little more. It'll slow down some of that wear and blow by. But that explains why the viscosity is so high. All the numbers look great. I mean, this engine looks like it's in great shape.
I've had good luck with it. I ran it, year and a half. That was the first oil sample on it. So,
keep doing what you're doing because the engine's running great and, it's tuned well and it looks like you've got plenty of life left in it.
That's kind of what I figured too. Now, I have not removed any of the EGR system that's on it, but I did block it out. And I have been documenting it, my fuel mileage and everything, since I got the truck. And started out at 4.2. And, of course, my fuel mileage, by blocking EGR out, changing the 9-speed that was in it to a 13. It's got 355 rears. What else? Oh, I brought it up. It was set at 400. I brought it up to 450 and brought the torque up to 1750 at this time.
Okay.
and my fuel mileage gained, I'm running at 5.7, 5.6 most generally.
Okay, so we're certainly on our way up from where you were. Let me ask you a question. I'm just kind of curious. Was there anything wrong with the transmission?
No. Well, at the time that I had it, went ahead and changed it over from the 9 to the 13, the synchronizers had went out.
Okay.
From high range down to low. And I had them fixed, and I can't remember the rest of it, but it's a 909A. The gears were already in it. They just had to, apply them.
This was a 9-speed convertible then. So the conversion was fairly simple. You didn't pull a 9-speed out and put a whole new transmission in.
Right. I did not.
Okay. Got it. Okay, good. Yeah, and that's something we always recommend. That conversion from the 9 is so cheap, you're crazy not to do it.
Yeah. It was like, I don't know, ended all of it somewhere in the neighborhood about $250 to do the conversion.
Yeah, yeah, which is pennies compared to, the gains you get. You know, it's not a huge fuel mileage gain. It depends on the operation. But it makes the truck more drivable. We do pick up some fuel economy in the hills, and it's just a nice, cheap fix. Like I say, you're crazy not to. Let's head off to Wheeling. John, welcome to the program. John, are you with me?
Yeah, hello. By golly, you are talking to me.
I am. There you go. Yeah. What's on your mind today?
There we go. I was daydreaming. I was just wondering if you had ever investigated any more on that hotshot stiction there. I've looked it over and I've seen all the reviews. Sounds real good. I've got an ISX kind of known to be dirty, and I've already had one of them puke due to poor oiling on the oilers in the back cylinder.
I keep playing phone tag with the owner of the company, and he's been doing a great job of reaching out to me, and he was busy traveling and I was busy traveling, and it is definitely on my list. It looks like I may get a chance to call him again this afternoon. And if he's available, I'll talk to him. I have a feeling, based on what I've read so far, that this might be one of those products that I recommend in a very specific circumstance. And I think I've been pretty clear that I am not a believer in oil additives on a regular basis. Same with fuel additives. I can use them the same way we might use a wrench. We use a wrench when something's broken, it needs fixed. Additives can be the same way. If something is broke or worn out or dirty and it needs fixed or cleaned, then we might be able to use an additive. For example, I recommend Lucas in a lot of different cases. If we have fuel dilution, coolant intrusion, an old worn out engine. But when we have a healthy functioning engine, I don't use additives of any kind just to use them. And I have a feeling that this product, once I come to understand it a little better and feel more comfortable with it, that it will probably become one of those products that will say, on this particular engine at this many miles, it might be good to put it in, run it for this long, get it back out. Let's make sure we oil sample. That's kind of where I think I'm going to end up with it right now. But I want to get some more details from the owner. The guy, from what I've read so far, knows a lot about oil. So I'm looking forward to talking to him. We just haven't been able to catch up yet.
All righty. Well, we'll just keep following up on it.
There you go. As soon as I do talk to him, I'll have to, and maybe we'll even get him on the air. We'll see. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. right, real quick, we're heading into the fourth segment of the first hour. At the end of the segment, I'll say I'm done. I've got to get out of here. Good night, all that stuff. Don't hang up. We're going to come back and do another hour. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment, so I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. I'm going to head off to Ohio. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I'm a one-truck operator right now, but I'm looking at leasing some trucks on.
Okay.
And is there any kind of a standard lease agreement that I could start with to for this?
Yeah, there are. Where you might find one is another matter. I don't know of one that I could point you to directly. I'm assuming you have your own freight and your own customers?
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah,
here's what I got
dedicated freight.
Yeah, here's what I would recommend. Even if you were to find a standard contract, I wouldn't use one. You know, you've done the hard work that very, very few people do. I mean, we look at even the majority of owner-operators who end up with their own authority, the vast majority of them run broker and load board freight. Very, very few people go out, secure their own customers, build those relationships. I would want to make sure that you had language in there that protected your customers.
Okay.
I would go to an attorney. Now, I would go to an attorney that specializes in trucking, and there are a couple, and I just drew a total blank. There are two that I work with and I've worked with over the years, and normally I can just, they're both strange names, like the typical law firms, but I am drawing a total blank right now.
Yeah, I sure like the name of one that's familiar with the trucking, you know, that's all I got to have.
Yeah. Do you listen to Kenny Long's podcast, Trucking with Authority?
No, I really don't.
I would recommend that you either go to that Facebook page or listen to the podcast. And even if you only listen one day and call in and ask Kenny,
I might shoot him a message because he just leased some operators on, didn't he?
And he really has been on top of the whole legal issues as far as that goes. And I know that the one attorney that Henry Seaton, that's the attorney's name. I would start with him, and it's Seaton. Henry Seaton, if you do a Google search, you'll find him. I would start there. I would also shoot Kenny a message. But I if I were you and I had my own customers, I would spend a little bit of money to make sure I had an attorney on my side that you know, instead of using a standard contract, make sure the attorney, and he may give you a boilerplate contract, but he may make a couple tweaks to it, and at least then you're getting his advice to make sure your customers are protected.
Right. Now, on something like that, they can, is it legal to write a no-compete clause for 5 years so somebody couldn't step in that was actually running it for me and take it?
I highly recommend non-compete clauses. Again, this is something you're going to get much better advice from the attorney, but there are no hard and fast rules about non-compete, but I will tell you how the courts look at them. If you make them too restrictive, the whole thing will get thrown out. 5 years, in my opinion, you might ask the attorney this, 5 years, in my opinion, is out of the question. I don't think most courts would ever allow you to block somebody out of competing for 5 full years. That's a long time. The longest, and I've signed some non-compete clauses. When I sold my accounting company, I signed a non-compete saying that I would not go back into that business again, but I only signed it for 12 months. That's, I think 12 months is enforceable. The other thing you've got to be careful of is if you make it too widespread, like you can't, you know, compete anywhere in the country. We'll forget it. The court's just going to throw that out. If you name specific customers, then that makes it a little more enforceable. But again, I'm not an attorney. I read up on this, but I would want you to talk to an attorney about that. But here's the other thing about non-compete clauses. Whether they're enforceable or not, just having them in the contract sometimes is enough to stop somebody from even trying, and they don't know the law.
Right. So that ain't going to hurt nothing, in other words.
Yeah, they're not going to hurt anything. If you want to actually be able to enforce it, which many times my view of the law is, look, by the time we get something to court, it's probably too late anyway. I mean, who wants to go to court and pay a bunch of attorneys and go through that crap? So honestly, I might be more inclined to write on a little stronger worded that maybe wasn't enforceable because I'm probably never going to take somebody to court anyway. I mean, really. So maybe we just write one in there, hope that it stops them from even thinking about doing it. But those are the kind of things that I think it makes it worth it to sit down and spend a little money with an attorney and get this done the right way.
Okay. Okay. Hey, I got one more question.
Okay, sure.
Still there, Kevin? Hey, when you test drove your truck to aim them headlights, how did them headlights work?
Well, you know, I knew what was going to happen. I always aim them at the door first, and you can get them pretty close doing it that way. But as soon as I pulled out onto the road, I could see I needed, I could tell you exactly what I needed. The right headlight needed to come in and down about a half inch in either direction. But other than that, they were great.
Well, you've had a lot of time to think about it. So when you take it back out again,
that's exactly right. So, and I am sitting here waiting for the email or the phone call to tell me it's done. So I can figure out how to get back there and get it home here. Let's go to Indiana. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin.
What's on your mind this afternoon?
Well, I kind of did a test over the holiday weekend, and I left my inverter on running my refrigerator, and the batteries were dead over the 5 days I was gone. I got the engine start module, but it wouldn't start it. And because it's not supposed to be able to draw off that start module, is that correct?
Yeah, who installed your start module?
DTI.
Yeah, we need to.
But here's what I did. I put my jump box on it for about 5 minutes, and then it started right up.
Yeah, which is nice. I mean, there's no question because, you know, the way my truck ends up sometimes sitting for 2 months at a time, and even the ESM after 2 months will draw down. So, but honestly, I don't know if you had to wait 5 minutes. Usually, by the time I hook my jump box up to the ESM, flip the switch on, climb up in the truck and hit the key, that's all it takes. I mean, mine usually starts right up. I don't have to wait any time at all. But
yeah, I mean, I just waited. I didn't try it before then, you know.
Yeah, I played around with mine so many times I figured out I could hook it right up and just hit the key and it would fire up with the ESM on there. But what I'm wondering, there's no way the ESM should have been drawn down in just a weekend. Something's wired wrong.
Okay. Well, I'll get with Ron and have him check it out next time I'm in there.
There is another possibility. I don't know if this is what may... See, I keep hearing about this, but I've never had it happen to me. That is that the batteries can be so dead the ECM won't power up.
Right, and they were dead. Like, I turned the key on, and, like, my odometer didn't you know, odometer light didn't come on or anything. I mean, it was dead.
Yeah. So, now, see, every ECM is a little different. According to Maxwell, if the batteries get down under 10 volts, they say a lot of trucks won't start because the ECM won't power up. On both of my trucks, a 60 series Detroit in a Volvo and a Freightliner with a Mercedes, those are the two trucks I've done a lot of testing on. I've checked my battery voltage all the way down to like 6 volts, which is just so dead. It's not even funny. And yet, as long as the ESM has power, mine always start right up. And every time I tell people at Maxwell that, they look at me and go, are you sure? I'm like, yeah, I've tested this a bunch of times. I checked my voltage at the battery. It's 6 or 7 volts. And yet the ESM has power and it starts right up. So you might want to get yours checked for wiring, though, to see if it's the ESM that's losing voltage. If it is, then something's wired wrong. If it's the ECM, then having that jump box is the way to go. And I think that's the way to go anyway, because they're small, easy to carry, and it makes the truck always start no matter what. There's the music. I've got to get to a break. No, I've got to get out of here. I'm done for the day. We'll see you back here next time. Be safe, be profitable, do the hard work, and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. All right, here we go. We're going to do another hour. Let's get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls. We answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, staying healthy on the road, dealing with the trucking lifestyle. You name it. We'll talk about it here on the air. All you have to do is pick up the phone and give me a call. I also want to tell you about our recording schedule. We record every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday afternoon. And we do it at the same time. It's always 1 p.m. Eastern time. That's when we start. Some days we record just 1 hour, some days two, and some days even 3 hours of recording. So it's real easy to join us. All you have to do is dial a number, and I'm going to give you that phone number in a little bit. So grab something to write with. You can just sit and listen to the recording as we do it, or you can jump in and ask a question. One of the things I hear all the time is how hard it is to get through on the phones. And I'm very grateful that that is the case. But I know it's frustrating for some people. And I will tell you, if you dial into our recording early and you just press one that lets us know you've got a question, you will get in with your question every time. Now, if you dial in late or you wait till later in the recording, sometimes we get a backlog. But if you want to get through, the recording is a better way to get through with your question. So I'm going to give you a couple ways that you can join us. One is just to put a reminder in your phone every Wednesday, Thursday, Friday afternoon, 1 p.m. Eastern time, and put this phone number in there, because all you have to do is dial this phone number. It's 347-884-8327. Now, if you remember this or put a note in your note, as soon as you get through, hit one on your phone, and I can just about guarantee we will get to your question. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday afternoon, 1 p.m. Eastern time, 347-884-8327. Now, I'm going to give you another way that we will remind you every time we're doing a recording or a podcast, and we'll do it by sending you a text message. And it's real simple to get on that list. you are going to text the word listen to 99,000. It's real simple. Just, you could do it right now. Just open up your phone and just like you would text something to anybody with a phone number, you're going to text to what is called a short code, 99000. That's the number you're texting to. One word, don't worry about capitalization. In the body of the text, just type listen. That's it. And hit send. Wait 30 seconds or less. You'll get a response back. That tells you that you're in our system. It's also real easy to get out of our system. Every time we send you a text, we send you the instructions for getting out if you want to. So you can control it. You can get in and out anytime you want, but that will put you on the list. We'll send you a text message reminder with the phone number every time we're doing a recording. Text the word listen to 99,000. All right. We are, what are we going to do? We are going to get to some phone calls. We're going to head off to Illinois. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I've kind of at a crossroads here. I've got a 2004 Columbia with a 14-liter Detroit, 355 rears. I'm running a flatbed operation from Michigan to Texas, and I've got $1.2 million on the truck, $400,000 on a Detroit rebuild. I'm getting nervous about the rear ends and the transmission, and I want to change the 10-speed auto shift over to a 13. I found a gentleman to do it for about $7,500 and $3,500 an axle to rebuild the axles. I'm wondering if I'm throwing good money after bad and I should just save my money and run it till the wheels fall off and possibly get a hold of Pittsburgh Power and put in an order this winter for a glider.
Well, first of all, tell me.
I'm sorry. I don't know anything on truck or trailer.
All right. First of all, tell me why you're worried about the rear ends.
The only thing I haven't messed with on the truck, 1.2 million miles outside of doing oil change, you know, changing out the fluids every 300,000. I've never done anything with them. You know, I just nervous, you know, trying to be proactive instead of reactive.
Yeah, and I get that. But let me just give you some of my experience. Most of my trucks I would keep to somewhere between 1.3, 1.5 million. I can't remember a single truck that I had any real differential problems on. Not even the ones that I converted to single axles using the lighter, you know, 20,000 pound differential, which everybody told me I couldn't do. Transmissions, the only real problems I had were my auto shifts. So I can understand if you want to get away from the auto shift. I like them, but they are a little riskier.
Problematic, right.
I would pull oil samples right now. Just like an engine. We can pull an oil sample on all those components and we'll get a pretty good idea of what shape they're in. And honestly, if you like this truck and it's running good, I would just pull an oil sample, maybe change out that 10 speed if you really don't like it. But I don't know that I would do anything with the differentials right now.
Okay, because my only other option was to try to invest into a lift axle for the front axle on the tractor if I didn't do that. And would it be worth, is $7,500 a fair price paid for a transmission swap with a clutch?
Yeah, that's about what I've paid the couple times that I have changed out transmissions. So that seems like a reasonable price. Now, reasonable really depends on what the transmission is that we're getting. I mean, what are they calling this? Is it used, reconditioned, remanned? What is it?
Reconditioned with a 200,000 mile warranty.
Okay. Yeah, that's a reasonable price then, especially with a clutch. I don't think there's anything wrong with that price at all. You know, you can't go wrong with a glider. I mean, if we look long-term, investing into a glider makes a lot of sense, but it's also pretty hard to go wrong keeping a truck you already own that's doing well.
Oh, right. Yeah. Trust me, I like not having a payment on either or.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we can keep reconditioning, rebuilding, replacing a whole lot cheaper than we can ever buy new. I mean, really, like I say, one of the things I'm looking into right now is replacing whole cabs. I mean, if we can take a cab off and recondition the frame and all the parts and do that for, I'm thinking we could do it for half the price of a glider, I think that's another great option.
Okay. So from your point of view, you're saying go ahead and spend the $7,500 to make it more drivable, because I hate the auto shift, and possibly look into a lift axle and take just full samples on the rear diff.
Yeah, and if for some reason you decide to do the differentials, then that is absolutely the time to do the lift axle, because you just cut your differential cost in half. You're only going to do one of them then.
And that's what I was wondering, is how expensive is a lift axle for a tractor versus a $3,500 to have it rebuilt? Would I have that or more into it, or?
Yeah, you're going to have more than that into it, depending. If you want to drive it into the shop, buy the axle, have somebody install it, you're looking at $6,000 to $7,000.
Okay.
But that's only, let's call it $3,000 more than just replacing the differential, and you'll pick that up in less than a year in savings.
Okay. Yeah, because I'm going down at 37,000 pounds. I come home on a dedicated lane with 15. So I'm looking to put a lift axle on the tractor and the trailer.
Yeah. And we see on the lift axle, depending on how often you keep it off the ground, we see a gain of, on the low side, 0.3, which means it just paid for itself in a year. And in some operations, as much as a half mile to the gallon, which means it pays for itself in about 7 or 8 months.
Okay. Now the company I'm leased on with, they don't have a Michelin account. How much of a difference am I? I'm running Super Single Goodyears versus the Michelins.
Yeah, you're losing 3 or 4 tenths right there alone. You can get your own Michelin Advantage account free, and then you get nationwide pricing. That's what I would recommend. And again, the Michelin tires over those Goodyears are going to pay for themselves in no time. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's head off to New Jersey. Danny, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing? I talked to you. I was the first caller on the last segment that lost signal. And my question was on doing the conversion, the Acer conversion to a single turbo. And I wanted it. I wanted to let you know that the person that I'm planning to get the kit from knows you, and he spoke very highly of you. J&S in Wisconsin, the Bully Dog, and that's the turbo manifold and everything.
Got it. And okay, so this is a full conversion back to a 6NZ. So,
yep.
So then we know that there is that is worth doing. Let me just start there. That makes that engine so much better. fuel mileage, we've seen increases of a mile per gallon or more. I mean, it is crazy.
I heard up to 2.2.
There might be some outside cases of that, but if you get a mile per gallon, my God, that's incredible. So, and we have certainly seen a mile per gallon and more. 2.2 could have happened, you know, in an extreme case. But again, it's worth doing. Now, having said that, the other thing that we have to be aware of, and I just have to keep saying that, it's illegal to do it. You are modifying the emissions on the engine. There was a time when I said, who cares? You know, they've killed us with these things. We've got to go make money. But then we started to get some stories of trucks going into shops, dealers, mostly big dealers. And I heard a couple stories where the people were told, your truck cannot leave the shop. Emissions are correct.
Really?
No, yeah. So now it can't be widespread. If it were happening a lot, I would be hearing about it more. I have heard in the last year maybe 5 stories, and I haven't been able to verify that they're all true. You know, sometimes this kind of stuff gets spread around and it grows, and but it is certainly possible. We do know that the EPA is cracking down on shops that are doing this kind of work, so we've got to be careful about that. Whether or not, so it's completely feasible, whether it's really happening, it is completely feasible that the EPA will put pressure on the big shops to verify that emissions are correct and force them to do it. So you've got to think hard about that, whether or not you're willing to take that risk. There are lots of people doing it, lots of people running around getting the benefits. Right now, it doesn't seem like a huge risk, but I'm at the point where I have to warn people that that is very possible. It could happen.
Now, I run from New Jersey to Maine at least once or twice a week. Like I told you before, I did the OPS. I did the air dog screw-on fuel filter thing. I did the fleet air. I changed the fuel lines. And I did notice an increase on fuel mileage and the engine performance. And for what I understand, if I was to do the conversion kit, I mean, I would benefit even more out of it. And I'm looking for, of course. And now another thing is that I'm running the Goodyear 399 on my steers. And then I went and I purchased, because I do intermodal, of course, I purchased these tires called Double Coin, China-made tires, and they're supposed to be the Michelin of the China tires, the Chinese tires. Well,
which model Double Coin do you have?
Wait till I tell you the number. 165 rolling resistance.
Oh, you've got the RLB 400s.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I don't know who calls those things the Michelin of Chinese tires, because they're not
the tires.
Yeah. I have a few choice words for him, but I'll skip those right now. So let me just give you the extreme here. That tire is at 165. Michelin's best wide single is at 89. That tire is costing you $6,000 a year in fuel.
Yep. I spoke to him last week or 2 weeks ago. I spoke to him. He told me to bring the truck back. I told him, listen, I'm not happy with the rolling resistance after I did this. I should have did it before I purchased the tires, but I obviously didn't. And I did tell him I want these tires removed. And he said he'll give me credit for the tires. And okay. I was going to go with the, I had two choices. One was the Goodyear, if I'm correct, 752s or 572s, something like that.
The other one
was a Michelin.
Sounds right.
I looked at the rolling resistance on both tires. One is 131,
That's the 572. So skip that. That's just still way too high.
Mm-hmm.
What's the other one?
And the other one was a Michelin. The Michelin, well, I can't remember the number of that Michelin, but it was a M, what was it? I know it was an NX or something like that.
You remember what the rolling resistance was on that one?
When I looked the rolling, I looked up the rolling resistance on that one. It was 117.
Okay. I'm trying to remember. I do know of a Michelin tire with that number, but I can't remember which one it is either. It's one of their odd tires.
Yeah.
It's not one of their more common tires, and I can't remember which one it is. Is that because those are your choices because that's what he stocks?
No. I mean, I can get, he's a tire shop. I mean, I can get whatever I want pretty much. Okay. I mean,
well, then what I
would
recommend.
Another tire was a BF Goodrich, which was, I think, was like an M series. That I looked at the rolling resistance on that one, and that was like 97, I think it was, or 99, something like that.
Well, then the choice to me is easy. Tires for me are
all about rolling.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. The lower the rolling resistance, the better. There are a few exceptions. I mean, it's like anything in life. Sometimes we make some exceptions depending on the situation. But when we look at how we're going to choose a tire, my number one criteria is always rolling resistance. Well, you're just looking for a drive tire. This isn't anything crazy. You're not doing off-road work. We're not doing anything unusual. So why not just go with the lowest rolling resistance?
Well,
here's
that's
the thing. One-tenth of a mile per gallon. One-tenth of a mile per gallon cost us about $1,000 a year. So if you have to buy two tires, people say, but look at how expensive that tire is. Well, yeah, but the other thing is we don't have to look at a tire and say, well, those tires cost me $5,000 to put them on, so I have to make up $5,000 in fuel cost. No, you don't, because the cheap tires still cost you $3,000 to put on. So you only have to make up the difference between the tires, which is really easy to do.
Well, that was my whole thing was that I realized on how much it was. Yeah, I did spend the cheap money on the cheap tires, but then I'm like, wow, this costed me more for these tires than if I would have just went and paid the big bucks for the good tire.
Right. Plus, you get a better tire.
Yep.
So now
I'm planning to change them.
Good.
I'm planning to change them, but the thing is, the reason I called was, I mean, I've called a couple times. I listen to your podcast all the time and everything. But my whole thing was that I wanted to get your opinion on that conversion kit before I go and order this because it's not a cheap conversion kit.
No, but now that I know which kit it is, we know the results. So my stance on this, the results are worth it. If we didn't have to think about the EPA, I'd say hands down, just go do it. And I might still do it if it were me. I mean, I might take the chance. But the other thing I will tell you is if you do this, I would never go anywhere near a big dealer. Not an engine dealer, not a truck dealer. I would only find independent shops where I knew the people and said, hey, look, you know, this is what I've done to my truck. Is this going to be a problem?
Okay. Yeah, well, the thing is like I said, I replaced everything else. I did everything else that I've heard you talk about.
There's still lots more you could do, and you may want to look at the other stuff first. You know, we have air tabs, flow below. I could go on and on. There are other things, and you may want to do those first because they're less expensive, and then use the savings to build up and think about the EPA thing. Again, now that I know which shop, the results will be good. You'll be very happy with them. It is expensive. You'll make your money back. I'm not worried about that. You do have to think about the EPA and what might happen in the future. I've got to get to a break. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. You know, I was talking a little bit in the last call about fuel mileage. We have lots and lots of things we can do for fuel mileage. We talk about rolling resistance, the fleet air filter, all the Pittsburgh Power products. There's a whole slew of those depending on your truck and your engine. You know, using the OPS and switching to synthetic oil, now also switching to 30-weight oils. But we also, you know, air tabs are a great product for everybody. The Flow Below is one of our newest products that I'm really excited about. We looked at this product and worked with the company for 2 years prior to announcing our partnership. You know, I talk about our method of testing. I want to get a 70% positive result. And some people say, well, why not 100? Well, because 100 is never going to happen. If we waited to get 100% positive result on fuel mileage products, I wouldn't have a show. We wouldn't be talking about this and nobody would be modifying anything. There are too many variables in fuel mileage. Sometimes we can explain why somebody didn't get results. Many times we can't. Unless I were to follow somebody around 100% of the time where they were testing, I don't know what goes on. There are very few people that understand fuel mileage testing well enough to be able to explain what might have happened. It's the same thing when we get really wild results outside of the norm. You know, we may test a product and get a solid 4/10 and somebody will call me and say they got 8/10. Well, probably not, because again, there was some other variable going on that they didn't account for, didn't understand. If we get a solid 70%, that product works. No question in my mind. I've been doing this for a very long time. The Flow Below is really running at about 90%. Which is extraordinary. We are getting outstanding results. It's a simple product, easy to install. You'll see a payback in 5 or 6 months, and you'll see a savings of $2,500 to $3,000 a year. Great product, very durable. The company is doing so well at the fleet level, which is also very unusual for a fuel mileage product, that they asked us to take over all of the owner operator marketing and support. And we are doing that. So we kind of think of this as our product now in the owner operator world. So you can get it on our website. If you have any questions, you can call us, but it's a very easy ordering process right on the website. It is an aerodynamic device that fixes the turbulence around the tandems on your tractor. Now, a lot of people say, well, I pull a flatbed, I pull a tanker, I pull a hopper, whatever it might be. It doesn't matter. Air tabs and the Flow Below together are a fantastic combination. So if you've already got air tabs, you got to get the Flow Below. If you don't have either one, get them both. Go to the website. It's letstruck.com/store or give us a call. It's 855-800-FUEL. I'm going to get to some phone calls. We're off to Kentucky. TJ, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
What can I help you with today?
I want you to clarify something for me on rolling resistance on these on tires, and I'll use a nice simple number of 100 as a rolling resistance number. Now, what I want to know on the four corners of your drives, okay? If you have two tires pulled up that are at 100, does that make the rolling resistance in that corner 200 versus to say you have a super single of 100? You only have one tire there. You know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. And the answer is that we always look at the position, not the number of tires. So it doesn't matter if it's a dual or a single, we're always looking at it as a position. For example, when we talk about the configuration of a truck, a tractor, we either call it a 6x4, a 6x2, or a 4x2. We're not counting the individual tires. We're just counting the individual position. So a 6x4, this confuses a lot of people. means we have six wheel positions. So we've got, you know, four drive positions and two steer positions. So there are six wheel positions. And in a 6x4, four of those positions are propelling the vehicle. So if we talk about a 6x2, it means we still have three axles, six wheel positions, but only two of the positions are driving the vehicle. So one of those drive axles is dead. In a 4x2, we only have two axles, four wheel positions, and two of them are driving the vehicle. So that helps you to, when we talk about rolling resistance, we're always talking about the position, not the individual number of tires.
Okay. All right, yeah, I got a 6x4. I just didn't know, you know, having two duals at 100 equaled 200 or having one super single at 100, which was the better way to go on the numbers.
The numbers are, we look at a set of duals and a single the same way. Here's another way to think about this. Okay. I can tell you the rolling resistance for your entire truck, but we don't add up all of the tires and say, like, let's say that, you know, your drive tires are 100, to use a nice easy number. Well, that would mean just in the drives, there's 400. And then let's say your steers were 100 too. We wouldn't say that your truck has a rolling resistance of 600. We would just say it has a rolling resistance of 100. We would add them all up and then divide by the number of positions. And if they were all 100, then your truck has a rolling resistance of 100.
Okay. That helps. I appreciate it. I won't take up no more of your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. That's a good question because I've had that one before, so I know that does confuse a lot of people. It's one of those things, once you understand how we do it, then it's pretty straightforward. Let's go to West Virginia. Adrian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. My question today is, what are the requirements for being able to receive per diem? I know you can't just live in your truck and, you know, the IRS will say, well, the truck is your tax home. Can you just have a piece of property? Could you get away with a P.O. box?
You know, there isn't a clear answer to this. The good news is the odds of you being audited are pretty slim, like less than 1 in 100. And if you do get audited, if you provide them with an address, they really usually just don't dig much deeper. As long as you provide them with an address and you don't make the statement, I live in my truck, then you're going to be fine. I mean, there's no place in the IRS that says we have to have a house. I mean, if we have a piece of property, we want to live in a tent, we can live in a tent. You know, if we had a piece of property and we wanted to sleep in the truck while we were at that property, that is still a home. That is still a tax home. Now, I don't want to get down to arguing details like that with the IRS. And the good news is you shouldn't have to. Just make sure you've got an address, a physical location. If you don't have one, find a relative who would vouch for the fact that you stay with them and you don't even have to pay anybody rent. I mean, that's not a requirement. If I had a friend or a relative that said, oh no, we provide him with a room anytime he's in town and this is what he calls home, that's all it takes.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing now, but I'm looking at moving and just buying a piece of property, and I just wanted to know if that would affect it. I might still just use that other address for my business, even, you know what I mean, but I've kind of like consolidated it all.
Yeah, so again, there's no clear requirements, but as long as you don't go into the audit saying, oh, I live in my truck, and then trying to backpedal saying, oh, but as long as you go in saying, this is where I stay when I'm off the road, this is home.
Makes sense. I appreciate you, Kevin. That definitely clears it up.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Yeah, you know, I'm glad it cleared it up. With the IRS, it's hard to clear up anything. But the good, you know, what we need to do is make sure we know what we're doing going in if we ever have an audit, we don't want to be surprised in the audit. We don't want to be backpedaling and trying to cover our tracks. We want to know. So I'm glad you asked the question. Just establish an address. Doesn't matter if you pay rent. A P.O. box, they could argue you can't live in a P.O. box. So it doesn't mean you can't have a P.O. box. And you can use that as your mailing address. But it, in an audit, if you ever ask the question, you want to be able to explain where you physically live when you're not on the road. What are you calling home? And that's all. I mean, just know that going in ahead of time. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment, so I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's head off to Utah. Dustin, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. It's good to talk to you. I've got a couple of questions about the scan gauge and something that's kind of it's messing up on me, and it's probably just something that I'm doing wrong, but perform a trip with it, say like on the A or the B trip. When I get to the end of the trip and say I've traveled 500-600 miles or something, it's saying that my max RPMs have been somewhere up around 8,000 or something crazy like that. And the max speed has been like 175 miles an hour or something. I'm just wondering if you could shed some light on why it's doing that.
No, it's getting that reading from the ECM at some point. And
okay,
I don't know that I would worry too much about this. I know it'd be nice if it was really accurate. I get the same thing on my GPS units all the time. When I go to look at my GPS unit, I'll get some goofy max speed reading and I'll be like, yeah, I know I didn't go 97 miles an hour on this trip. Right. And I think it's just the same thing. It only takes 1 second of a crazy voltage change in the ECM to record something like that. You could try playing around with the, you know, when you go through the settings, you have the different, the J1939, 1708 or both. You could try switching back and forth on those and see if that changes it. But I've seen some trucks where the ECM just puts out that garbage data every now and then, and the unit just collects it because it was there.
Okay. I've tried messing around with both modes, and it seems to do the same thing on either mode or even if it's on both. So it's probably just something my ECM is doing crazy. It does seem to follow the fuel mileage, and everything else seems to be perfect and to the T. So,
yeah, like I said, because it's a recording function, you know, the unit is sitting there looking for that highest number during that period. So all it takes is one blip on the ECM, and the unit says, oh, there it is. There's the biggest number. It's okay. Not like, you know, like oil pressure could blip like that, but you'd probably never even notice it. So that's really because it's that trip A and B function, and it's looking for that one time. That's all it takes is a second of a weird signal coming out of the ECM, and then that's what you get.
Okay. I'm wondering if also sometimes when I go say a stop and fuel, shut the truck off and turn the truck back on and get pulling out of the parking lot. I'll look down and the scan gauge isn't even on, and I'll just reach down and unplug it from the unit itself, plug it right back in, and it kicks right back on. Maybe it's picking up something weird right there. I don't know.
Could be. What year and what engine?
It's a Cat A cert, and it's an 07.
Okay. Yeah, you know, there are several things. Could be a voltage issue somewhere in the system. It could be the data port itself. It doesn't sound like it's causing any major problems, though.
No. And it's, like I said, it's following everything else pretty much to the T. Those were the only two things that I'm going, why is it doing that? I know I didn't do 175 off of Baker grade or something, you know. That's just, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know of any fix to that. If that's all it does, I guess I really wouldn't worry about it, though. We, like I say, for some reason, some of my GPS, even my Garmin's, which are so good at some things, I don't think I've noticed it on my new Rand McNally tablet yet. But I used to get those weird max speed readings, like, okay, who was driving my truck at 110 miles an hour? Let's head off to Pennsylvania. Adam, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good afternoon, Kevin. I got a couple questions here for you today. One was, I have a 2010 ProStar ISX, and I was wondering about going to Pittsburgh Power and having them reprogram the ECM. I was wondering how much you thought I would benefit from that and roughly what that cost to do that.
The one thing I don't try to keep a handle on is prices, because we deal with so many companies and so many things, and prices always change. And then I feel bad if I give somebody the wrong number. So, I have no idea, especially when it comes to ECMs, because different years, different ECMs. The first thing you need to ask them is, can they reprogram? Well, let me clarify that. They can always tweak it within the guidelines of, you know, what has always been allowable within an ECM. Custom programming requires that they do the programming a very specific way, then do their EPA testing, which they've done a lot of. But again, I don't always know which ECMs, how much they can do to them. The more they can custom program, the better results you're going to see. I mean, I can tell you that for sure. So, but to get down to the details of what they can do on your particular ECM and what it would cost, you're going to have to give them a call.
Okay. Because I thought I remember Bruce saying something about there's like 1,500 programs in one of these you don't even need.
Yeah, it's crazy, you know, the stuff that goes on in those ECMs, and almost all of them, they can at least go in and clean them up and tweak a little bit. Some of them, they can really do some amazing stuff.
Yep. Another question I have for you, Kevin, was a few weeks back, you were talking about that cover up with Cummins and the cams and stuff like that and the OPS systems. And there was a guy that called in, and he was talking about oil pressure, you know, with the Cummins engine, talking about being at 38 pounds doing 65 miles an hour, and talking about the lower oil ports being too small. But it was a design flaw, and I couldn't remember, was that you that was actually saying that, or was that him that was saying that about the oil ports? And then, you know, oil being able to get in the lower part of the engine. And
yeah, that was the caller that brought that to our attention. And we've done some follow-up. There are some lawsuits going on about this. I'm not entirely clear. There was a recall that had something to do with the ceramic part in the fuel pump. And Cummins was claiming that's what was causing all the issues. Well, this guy got it into a shop, and the shop said, look, we stopped even doing that recall because it had nothing to do with the problem whatsoever. Here's the problem. The soot is clogging these oil ports. We're losing oil pressure. The bottom of the pistons aren't getting enough oil, and they're wiping out engines. And we also know that engine, for some reason, builds up enough soot in the filters that it loses oil pressure. I just, it seems like this engine, you know, I was saying back in 03, I thought that engine was way too complicated. And then they, you know, when they had to put EGR on it, and that was why they designed it, because they knew EGR was coming and they had to do something. Their N14, they just couldn't meet the requirements with that design. But I think that they just struck out with this design. I mean, I think Cummins really needed to start all over, because this engine has just had a host of problems.
Yeah, well, that just really freaked me out when I heard that. And I actually asked my mechanic about it, and he was saying he's seen some of these Cummins engines as low as 750,000 miles on them, with them cylinder walls and stuff being scored. And so that really kind of freaked me out. And, you know, I'm the guy that actually called in and started all this controversy with this Hot Shot Secret. I was the first guy to call in and talk to you about this. And
You know,
one thing I wanted to tell you about that is, remember I was telling you that when I first ran it, and I ran it with full synthetic, I had clocked 3 oil filters and 28,000 miles. And before I ran the synthetic on a regular oil change of, say, regular oil on 12,000 miles, about halfway through, about 7,000-8,000 miles, I would start losing oil pressure. And so then I would change out the oil filter and I'd get the oil pressure right back and I'd be good to go till the next oil change. Well, since I ran that stuff, I've changed my oil like 4 times now, and it holds the oil pressure all the way until it's time it's due again. So I really think that stuff really cleaned my motor out really well, because it really, really changed it. A lot.
Well, and you know, it's possible that there are some engines that need this kind of cleaning. You know, I when we look at pre-emission, whether it's an N14, a Series 60, a 6NZ Cat, you know, we've torn those engines down at 1.3, 1.4 million miles, and they're not dirty. There really is no buildup inside. So on those engines, I just don't know that. Additive like this. The ISX, maybe we do. The next thing we have to worry about is if you use this, Cummins has a history of saying, we're not going to cover the warranty because you did this. Doesn't mean it's right, but they've been doing it. I'm going to do some more research and I will let everybody know what I find out. I've got to get out of here. Thanks for joining me. Be safe, be profitable, do the hard work, and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
Thanks for tuning in to The Audio Road. If you have any questions, give us a call at 855-800-FUEL. That's 855-800-3835. Check out the website at letstruck.com and find us on facebook.com/letstruck.